Thanks, Mike, and thanks to David for powerfully leading us in prayer. I know I say it every time, but I really do mean it. It is always a pleasure to open God's word. It's to you, I don't take it for granted. It's not a given, and I always look on it as the last time I ever preach, so hopefully it's not. I don't know what it is about the British and queuing, but I was in the bank, I won't say which one, I was in the bank the other day, post the COVID, and we were standing quite close, and it was quite a queue, and the lady came to where the cashiers were, and it looked like she was going to open another queue, so the people standing in front of me decided that they would move over and start queuing where they thought the next cashier would be, only to find that she wasn't going to open the cashier side. She was counting the money that someone was giving her at the side. And so I moved to what now was the front of the proper queue, and I got some very nice comments. We will follow anybody if we think it's going to lead us somewhere where we want to go. Another example was I was on an orienteering course as a youngster at school, a weekend off from studying, and we were being led by somebody who thought they knew what they were doing, only to find that 5 hours into this orienteering course, we were being led round the garden path. And I just happened to say to the lad that was leading us, "We're lost, aren't we?" To which he replied, "No, we're not lost, it's just we don't know where we are." This generation likes to follow, or like to think that they're being followed themselves. We think of Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. But this morning we're going to look at following Jesus through this passage that we have been given in Mark. And today marks the first in a series of Calvary, to Calvary and beyond. And we're basing that series in the Gospel of Mark. Mark had begun his gospel by revealing Jesus' identity. Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, Mark chapter 1, verse 1. And in the first 8 chapters of his gospel, Mark shows us the beauty of Jesus' life. No one in the book had confessed Jesus up to then to being the Christ, the long-awaited Messiah, the descendant of David, who would vanquish Israel's enemies and bring in everlasting kingdom. No one, that is, until Peter. Mark 8, verse 29. This is the major revelation we saw as Mike read that passage. Jesus asked his disciples what the crowd thought of him. And he asked his disciples what they thought of him. And Peter spoke for the group, confessing that Jesus is the Christ. We read that immediately Jesus silenced his disciples, though they were right that he was the Christ. He is the Christ. They had the wrong idea of who he was and what he would do and what he would be. If they'd gone around telling everyone that they'd found the Messiah, the fervor of the region that Jesus was in, they would have reached boiling point. Everyone would have expected Jesus to drive out the Roman Empire and to establish his rule and throne. But as we shall see in the preceding weeks, Jesus was telling the disciples, Jesus was telling those around him that he had come to die. Jesus came first to die. He will come again to reign. But his first coming required his death. There is no kingdom without the cross of Christ. So the disciples needed to be quiet until they learned the full gospel. Then they could preach with their every breath, but until then they were to be silent. So after Jesus started teaching his disciples about his coming death and resurrection, our scene today unfolded. He called the crowds together. He gathered them with his disciples and he began showing them what it looks like to be a true disciple, what it looks like to follow Jesus, to follow him. Again, the disciples have only recently confided in him that they believe that he is the branch of David who will usher in an age of righteousness that will cover the earth like the waters cover the sea. Their internal excitement and apprehension must have been off the chart. The Messiah has come, and he has, for whatever reason, chosen us to be his followers. What will the rest of life be like? It's clear in other texts that these people envisioned thrones, supernatural powers, and great wealth. They thought of glory. They thought of greatness. So Jesus needed to start the process of teaching them what life in his kingdom would be like. And so we read from verse 34. Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul?" This passage is central to the Christian life and experience. It was designed to reprogram the disciples 2,000 years ago. And as I've been looking at it over the week, it can reorient ourselves today. So the first point is the attractiveness of following Jesus. "If anyone would come after me, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me." Why would someone want to come after Jesus? If you think about it, no one else could say what Jesus said. It hints at his deity if a teacher or even a prophet invited people to follow them in this way. We would call it blasphemy. His invitation is one of full-scale devotion, of ridding ourselves of self-centeredness and replacing it with Christ-centeredness. In essence, he wants us to lose our lives for him. He wants us to preserve our souls by being his disciples. He wants us to find motivation in his return, in the glory of his Father with the holy angels, verse 38. No other person could ask for this. Only God can command this level of allegiance. But the crowd and the disciples would have been interested in following him. This is why he started by saying, "If anyone would come after me. This points us to the attractiveness of following Jesus, the attractiveness of his life. Anyone could say those words, but when Jesus says it, we listen because his life is so beautiful. He knows about life. At this point in Mark, the crowds and the disciples didn't really understand who they were dealing with. They'd heard a bit and knew a bit about the life of Jesus, but what really amazed them, as Campbell Morgan has called it, is the spell of Jesus. He was appealing then, and he is appealing to us today. We look at him and know that he knows about life. He knows how to live. Even before the cross, the crowds could look at Jesus and see he knew the secret to life. And the secret to life is something all of us are after. We know in our souls we don't really know how to live, how to be alive. We sense something that is missing, that we're doing it wrong. We have luxuries. We have scientific advancements. We have great wealth. We have education. We have entertainment. We have literature. We have gadgets. We have Alexa. We have great cities and societies. We've built great nations. We have innovation. But so often, we don't have the sense that we are human. Something is amiss. We walk about sometimes like zombies. We pass through life. We don't feel as if we're living out a great human destiny. Here is Jesus. He knows about us. He knows about life. He doesn't follow his passions, but his life has great meaning. He doesn't have any possessions, but he is satisfied like no one of us has ever been. He doesn't have power, instead serving and lowering himself for others. In that, he is highly exalted. Jesus knows how to really live. He knows the secret of life. When whoever is preaching gets to Mark chapter 10, we will see a young, wealthy young man who comes to Jesus looking for eternal life. And he didn't know what we do. He wasn't asking, how does salvation come? Is it by faith? He wanted the kind of life that Jesus had. He wanted whatever Jesus was living. He had youth, something many in our society are chasing, even me. People want to look young, feel young, act young. They fear aging. Often those who fear aging are the worst. We are the worst. But this man, this young man, was successful in his prime, in his youth. He had power. Luke calls him a ruler. People looked to him for leadership. Still a young man, he had an ability and a talent which drove him to the top of his community. He had wealth. Mark says he had great possessions. Luke says he was extremely rich. But he didn't have life. He didn't have what we saw in Jesus. When he looked at Jesus, he did not see a young man. Jesus was in his early 30s, but that wasn't necessarily young in those days. And at the top of that, his ragged life of carpentry in Nazareth and his tireless ministry in Galilee seemed to have taken their physical toll. When Jesus told the religious leaders that Abraham had seen his day, a statement of divinity They said, "You are not yet 50 years old and you have seen Abraham." John chapter 8 verse 57. They told a 30-year-old man that he was not yet a 50-year-old man. I take it to mean Jesus looked a lot older than he was. The man looked at Jesus. He did not see power. He saw a servant. He saw someone willing to move to the outskirts of the town to avoid conflict with the religious leaders. And though he didn't know it, he saw the Son of God who lowered himself by becoming flesh for humanity. And when the man looked at Jesus, he did not see wealth. Jesus was content with no home. He was satisfied with little. But for all of this, the man was attracted to Jesus. He knew, as we know today, that Jesus was truly living. He knew how to live. So this was the attractiveness of Jesus. And now we move to something that was weighing on my mind when preparing and looking at what was happening and unfolding in Ukraine and thinking about the church that I'd seen for myself in Eastern Europe. The cost of following Jesus. Verse 34, and calling the crowd to him with his disciples, he said to them, "If anyone would come after me, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me." So Jesus is attractive and he is the Christ. But they needed to know what kind of Messiah he would be, because the wrong view would lead to a wrong view of discipleship. Jesus told them the cost of following him, that they would need to deny themselves, to take up their cross. This isn't Jesus' way of telling us that we must deny our personality, or even to die as a martyr, or even to live an ascetic life that's detached from reality. He's not talking about self-denial that leads to personal gain. Dieting, exercise, or personal discipline. No, when Jesus said that someone should deny themselves, it wasn't his way of saying they should deny the things the self wants. There's yourself over there in the corner, as REM would say, "Here's me in the corner losing my religion." He's not saying sit there in the corner and deny yourself. Keep things from self. The self is not some detached part of you that Jesus tells you to deny. He isn't asking for mere sacrifice. Instead, Jesus is saying the self should be displaced and renounced. Life was about self. Now it must be about Jesus' life in the individual. This means self leaves the throne of our hearts and Jesus sits upon it. As the Apostle Paul says, "It's no longer I that live, but Christ who lives in me." And further on he says, "For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain." These are negative and positive commands. The negative, deny yourself. The positive, take up your cross. The negative, step off the throne. The positive, surrender the throne of your heart to Jesus. Whatever he assigns you, whatever cross he asks you to take it up and follow him. This is, of course, the life Jesus lived. He had an assignment from God. It included the literal cross, the cruel method of torture designed by the Romans, but Jesus was destined to partake of it since the Old Testament scriptures suggested that it would be the way that Jesus would die. Psalm 22, if you'd like to look at that. And we're to embrace the cross. When Jesus said these things, cross-bearing was not an established metaphor. The cross was a terrible and very Roman contraption. It was the means for Rome to humiliate those under subjugation. They would crucify rebels on the entrance to a town, on the main roads, as a way of telling every passerby who was in charge. How much of that have we seen in the last week in Ukraine? Every Ukrainian street bears the mark of Russian involvement and terror and death. And a person on their way to be crucified would carry their own cross. They were submitted to Rome, in other words. So when Jesus tells us to take up our cross, it's not a way of telling us to put up with a sickness or a trial or a difficult person or a difficult relationship. It's not his way of saying that we should endure times of difficulty. He's instead telling us to give him total allegiance. And this is how we apply this passage. He's telling us to give him total allegiance. This coming week, yield everything to Jesus. Follow him no matter the cost. All of this talk of self-denial and taking up your cross sounds like a tall order. And it's right. It is. But Jesus knew the task of spreading the gospel through the whole world would be difficult, and he also knew the secret to real living. So he did not hold back. He told people exactly what it would take. Jesus, you see, is interested in quality over quantity. He knows his message of discipleship will not appeal to the general population. The crowds would not receive it. Who would? But it is the secret to real living. Jesus makes it clear. Deny yourselves, deny myself, and take up your cross and follow me. In Luke, Jesus spoke of a man who built a tower and a king who went to war. Luke 14. The man building the tower first sits down and counts the cost. The king going to war first sits down and calculates if he has a large enough army and what it will take. I'm sure that Putin has been doing that over the last few weeks. How many rubles will it take to invade, and what will the cost be? Forgetting the cost to Ukraine and forgetting the cost to his own people, who, by the way, do not have a real view of what is going on in Ukraine. Only what the state tells them is happening. So the king going to war first sits down and calculates if he has the money and the army to do what he intends to do. Jesus is no different from the tower builder and the general king. He counts the cost of building and warring, and what he needs to get the church built and the war won are disciples. It's you and me. We are the hands and the feet, as Mother Teresa and Teresa of St. Avila both say. Jesus has no other hands and feet on earth today except you and me. We are the hands and feet of Jesus. And so what does Jesus need to get the church built and the war won in discipleship? are people who bear their cross in allegiance to him. But this is where the cost of discipleship is too much for so many. It sounds impossible. It sounds like a losing proposition. So rather than follow Jesus, we make our compromises and continue to settle for less than real living. We turn Christianity into something cheap, easy or weak, and thereby dilute to the point it's lost its potency. But I would suggest that potent Christianity is real living. Jesus gives us promises about the life following after him. He gives us some promises. The promise number one, you'll find your life. We cannot find it by grasping for it, fighting for it, for self, trying to get it over the backs of other people. We see it in society, people trading in relationships for newer ones, people trading in and biting and devouring to greedily amass more and more for themselves, spending hours doting on what they have and what they haven't. The second we try to do that, as I know to my own cost, you put yourself on the throne and you lose your life. It slips through your fingers. But as we read about the believers in Acts, they formed a new community. They paved a new way of Jesus living. They continued with one another. They made relationships with other believers and made it a major priority. They gave and sacrificed for one another. They shared Jesus with their cities. They stayed committed to lives of righteousness. They obeyed Jesus' call for their individual lives. They found life, and what happened? Many were added to their number each day. Promise number two, you'll keep your soul. Too often we forget that we're compromised or we're comprised of more than our bodies. Our bodies are very much who we are. What we do with them helps shape our inner person. But we are more than the outward person. We have souls. And there is no gain, according to Jesus, in gaining the whole world, yet losing our souls. To lose your soul is equivalent to wasting your life, looking back and realizing you'd spent it on all the wrong things. People neglect and devalue their souls all the time, in pursuit of possessions, of power, of passions. And you can get those things, but your soul is gone. You are no longer you, but an amalgam of other people's priorities and desires. Again, I've been there, got the t-shirt. You can't live somebody else's life or ask somebody else to live your life. And as a Christian, we can't hang on to the coattails of somebody else's faith. Jesus died for us. Jesus died for me. Jesus died for you so that you could have a personal relationship with him and to God. It's no good getting to heaven and saying, I was hanging on to the coattails of Carl Woodward, and God will say, why? Didn't I do enough for you? What did I do for you? What I did for Carl, I want to do for you. Look to yourself. And this really is the last point. Having done all that, you'll enter glory. Finally, we come to the last promise. But Jesus states it in the negative, that those who cannot abide the disciples' life, those who are ashamed of Jesus, and especially ashamed of his words, when Jesus returns in glory, he will be ashamed of them. They will not be part of his future glory. But it's all too easy to be ashamed of Jesus. What did Peter say when he was standing in the courtyard when the servant girl came up to him and said, "You're one of his followers, you're one of the disciples. I never knew him." And he did that another two times. "I never knew him." There are obviously things about this, his life, that are palatable to someone. But what should be palatable more than anything is his love, his grace, and his mercy, as we see displayed before us this morning in bread and wine. The fact that he died on the cross for our sin is repulsive to many. And Jesus spoke words of judgment and righteousness, which many in our generation hate. But the disciple, those that have denied themselves and taken up their cross, love Jesus' life and love and live his words. We build our lives upon the life of Christ and the word of Christ, and one day we will discover just how worthwhile it was to make him our priority. Dietrich Bonhoeffer puts it better. He was a German pastor who was rightly or wrongly implicated in the plot to assassinate Hitler. But he was one of very few pastors in Germany who spoke up about and against the Nazi regime. And he has written the most powerful books on discipleship that you will ever read. And I'm quoting from his book, The Cost of Discipleship. And this was written a week before he was killed himself. And I quote, "Costly grace is the gospel which must be sought again and again and again. The gift which must be asked for, the door at which we must knock. Such grace is costly because it calls us to follow, and it is grace because it calls us to follow Jesus Christ. It is costly because it cost a man his life, and it is grace because it gives a person the only true life. It is costly because it condemns sin, and grace because it justifies the sinner. Above all, it is costly because it cost God the life of his Son. You were bought at a price, and what has cost God much cannot be cheap for us. Above all, it is grace because God did not reckon his Son too dear a price to pay for our lives, but delivered him up for us." And he ends, "Costly grace is the incarnation of God." Amen.